Two Pints in a Corner is a music history podcast about the Channel Club in Boston, Mass. Dinky Dawson and Tony Rain are your hosts. They interview channel performers and workers, bringing out stories and memories of the great music and events that came through this iconic South Boston venue.
Welcome to Two Pints in a Corner podcast with Tony Rain and Dinky Dawson. Tony, unfortunately, is still under the weather, so we haven't got him to talk today, but we do have a guest interviewer, is Sean McNally, our gentleman from the channel that used to be the head of security and do this, that, and the other with production, and there's Cringe and many other things on the side, but he's still doing the bands and stuff, and we have Extreme's manager on there called Joanne Cordy. Are you there, Joanne?
I am right here, Dinky. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And Sean, you're there, right?
Yes, sir, Dinky. Good to talk to both of you.
Oh, this is good. So we'll start with Joanne. I basically, one of the questions that's always got me is, how did you really, really start? Was it with Dream or before that with managing groups?
I started actually producing concerts for the Cancer Society.
Oh,
and
fantastic.
I used rock bands because a lot of my friends were musicians, and so they were free entertainment that I could fill, and I knew they had friends that would come and buy tickets, and I therefore could then raise money for the charities. We also did the Jerry Lewis Telethon. I don't even think it exists anymore, but every Labor Day weekend, that was a big deal.
Yeah,
in Boston,
really.
That was a very big deal. So we would do some, I created something called the Rockathon, and I would have 5 or 6 bands on a bill. And I think the last one we did, we had like 8 bands on the bill. It started in the afternoon and went well into the night. And we would raise money, and the bars that we performed at were always very generous. And then we would go to the Dorothy Quincy Suite in Boston, where they would televise our, you know, Boston satellite location, and we would present the check to whoever was hosting here in Boston. And so that's how I started.
That's
and
fantastic.
I did a lot of work with guys that were in a group called Adrenaline, and Adrenaline had Gary Cherone, who was of course the singer for Extreme, and Paul Geary, who was the drummer for Adrenaline, then became the drummer for the Dream, subsequently Extreme, and then left Extreme to become one of the most prolific managers in music today. And in his place, Kevin Figueroa is now on the drums for Extreme and has been for years.
Wow.
But that's how I started.
Wow.
And I did work with Paul and Gary, and then that became the Dream, and I just sort of fell into the role.
Well, you really got into a good role because you've done a really wonderful job with this band and stuff. And whatever you started on over the years, that's incredible. And
thank you.
So, today you look around and it's a male thing. But then I look around and I said, there's some great women that used to run these places and are retired now and stuff. And you're the one of the last remaining ones that started in the beginning there, in the early 80s and stuff. I think we're talking about the channel now, but you in particular, when I'll ask this question, I'm sure Sean's got a bunch of questions too. Do you remember the first experience with the channel?
Yes. My first time going to the channel was to perform, to have the Dream, which was the first sort of incarnation of Extreme, open for probably Berlin Ellis.
Wow.
And I think they were not Berlin Ellis. They were called Luna.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
Remember
so that was the first time.
Yeah.
I'm going to say it was 1980.
That's when the channel opened.
Yeah.
That's when the channel opened. Sean
was
and I did.
Mad Hatter?
It was the Mad Hatter.
Yeah, before then.
It was definitely a funky place before then, and it then changed over even more funky place with the channel. But it's a big venue, a big venue, and that was the thing that the lads there that let everybody do it. And the main instigators were like, you know, people like Warren and stuff, that Warren Yaffe that was booking more than anything. Harry and Peter would be in the background more than anything, and let everybody else run it, you know. And Tony Raine came in around 84, when I came in 84. Sean was there. You were there before us, Sean, weren't you?
No, right after you, Dinky. We were trying to figure this out last time. I know the first show was the Southside Johnny was there one night. I went in as a special guest as a friend of somebody. And I think it was 85, fall of 85. Most likely when I got there. And I stayed till almost the bitter end, 1990, before the place got closed down. Opened briefly for another incarnation, so to speak.
Yeah, I get you. Because I left it at that time and what have you. I took all my gear out of it, all the production stuff and everything. But
let me jump back in for a second. So I want to get back. I don't want, this is not like a Joanne's like a one trick pony, but the dream / extreme is a pretty amazing story. I mean, I want you to kind of go back on how the name changed, if you don't mind, and how they kind of got the start and who gave them the buzz. But I think one of my memories from the channel of, you know, we had a lot of great local headlining bands back then. You know, it was just a golden age between, you know, the Extremes of the world, the Fahrenheits, the John Butcher Axises, the Fools, the Stompers, Rick Berlin, you know, TH and the Records. There were so many. Boom, Bim, Scala, Bim, among others. But I remember with Extreme playing there, but this is before they were signed. You could kind of tell they had the it factor, I guess is the best way to say it. Yeah. You know, they had their own little stage show. They had even like little production things. Like I remember they brought in little ramps so Gary could run up these little ramps barefoot give the audience like more of a show and a performance. Like they to me, they always felt like they really knew what they were doing and on their way to something bigger and better. But maybe Joanne, if you don't mind, they kind of jumping back in, because that's, you know, they started off like babies, like didn't really know much of anything as far as I could tell. And then they really got, between Gary and then the future members of the band, they really kind of had their own calling and made quite a move in Boston before they went out and exploded nationally. But maybe you can kind of go back to that time where they got the name from.
Well, I think influences, or their influences, you know, had a big impact on just what they could envision for themselves. And I guess what I'm trying to say is, like Gary, for instance, in his stage show, and doing the ramps and things like that. I mean, he touched his teeth on Aerosmith and Steve Tyler, Freddie Mercury and Queen, you know, Roger Daltrey and The Who. These were bands, the Rolling Stones and Mick Jagger. These were the bands that he sang into his hairbrush, you know, when he was a kid. And I think he felt like in Boston, especially because that's, you know, that was where our stomping ground, it was lacking that sort of show. And it was important. He always called himself a showman versus a singer.
Ah.
If you ask Gary, you know, give us, you know, one word, like, how would you describe yourself? He would say a showman.
Yeah, sure.
And they also, you know, as far as the dream, the first sort of endeavor from Adrenaline. So let me give you the marriage there.
Oh.
It was a group called The Direction, and the main players in The Direction was a guitarist, Peter Hunt, and a bass player, Eddie Goulart. And then in Adrenaline, you had Paul Geary on drums and Gary Cherone lead vocal. They married. In other words, the two guys left The Direction, the two guys left Adrenaline, and formed a band which they called The Dream. And Eddie and Peter were a little bit older and had been playing out a little bit longer. And they were just very instrumental in giving Paul and Gary direction, pun intended. But, you know, just sort of some mentorship as they put these songs together and put a show together and put us together. And one of our very first show as The Dream. And as I said, I was working with Adrenaline doing shows, and that's when they opened for Luna. Then, of course, that band went through their own transitions and became Berlin Ehrlich. And Adrenaline and The Direction became The Dream. And when the Dream first played their very first show, it was opening for James Montgomery at Jasper's Nightclub in Somerville.
Oh, right.
And we also opened for the Jim Carroll Band
at Jasper's. Yeah.
Which just remember the Jim Carroll Band, because that comes back into the extreme lore a few years later. But once Berlin Ehlers came back on the scene, you know, they really had a built-in audience. They were very popular, and they played the channel quite a bit, and would have us open for them. And that helped us just gain some buzz, some popularity, some new fans. And we also brought a lot of our own fans with us. We're that kind of band. We drew a lot of females to the show.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the males would come because the males knew the females were going to be at the show. So we always had a pretty good following.
That's great.
And so we're called The Dream, and we're really working hard to establish ourselves as a viable band and try to grow with each and every gig. And as a young manager, I started out just doing marketing for them.
Yeah.
So getting a mailing list together. They had t-shirts. I mentioned the Jasper's opening up for James Montgomery, because we had t-shirts on sale, our very first gig, which we got, you know, they mocked us like, who are these kids kidding? But, you know, we sold them, and then we used that money to buy more, and we just always had merch, and we always had t-shirts and, you know, the satin, you know, road jackets and things like that.
Yeah.
But one day, well, as I said, as a young manager and not really an experienced person in that realm, and I didn't have a lot of mentors. As Dinky, you mentioned, I mean, there was Billy who managed Berlin Ehlers, you know, and Nance Greenspan was in the scene, you know, working with Linda Pratt. And, but there really just wasn't a lot of, role models for me. And so I just had to play it by gut. And one thing that I did, because I just thought everybody did this as a band manager, was trademark the band name.
Yeah.
So I trademarked the band name. And as it turns out, Gary comes to me with this Tiger Beat magazine, and it's got a picture of John Stamos, and it's talking about, you know, he just left General Hospital and he has a brand new show coming out this fall, and it called Dreams, about a struggling rock band, you know, trying to make it.
Oh,
no. And the very next day after Gary came to the office with this Teen Beat magazine with the picture of John Stamos, I get a phone call from someone that called themselves an attorney for a New York band. And they said they represent this band and that our logo looks quite a bit like their logo. And they're about to get signed, and they really don't want any confusion. So they'd like to buy our logo, name, likeness, whatever. They'd like to buy it from us.
Wow.
And I'm like, what? So I said, well, you know, what label? I said, are you signed? No, not yet. Okay. And I said, how much are you talking about? They said $10,000. And I said, well,
okay.
First of all, I don't know any unsigned band who has $10,000 to buy somebody's logo because it looks like theirs. And secondly, it's going to cost you a whole lot more than $10,000. So then they called back again, and now they up it to $20,000.
Oh,
and
my.
That was like 2 days later. And I said, you know, I don't know who you are, but I'm going to find out, because there's just no way that an unsigned band has 20 grand. Like, I don't even know what this is about. So I call a lawyer, and he finds out that it's Centerpoint Productions out of L.A., and they're producing this TV show on CBS called Dreams, starring John Stamos. And I go, holy shit, pardon my French. I had the magazine right on my desk. And so it all made sense. So we filed suit, and we put a cease and desist on the show. And whoever was in charge just didn't do their homework. And they had already put, 13 episodes in the can. And
oh, wow.
Before anyone actually realized, they didn't have Google at the time, you know, before they actually realized, that somebody else owns the dream, which was a young rock band struggling to make it. So we ended up settling out of court for an undisclosed amount, which was considerably higher than what they were offering.
Yeah.
But the deal, they actually presented us with two deals. One, it's almost like the lottery, right? One was a lump sum, and the other was like $75,000 plus $1,500 an episode.
Oh.
And it was supposed to air, you know, weekly for 13 weeks, both the fall and spring season. So we had a little meeting, and I didn't make the right decision, but I said to them, look, the Monkees was a great success. The Partridge Family was a great success. You know, this is in the 80s, it's, you know, music was everything to us. I sure. said, you know, John Stamos was very popular on General Hospital as Blackie, and he was a musician. And I said, this could run 5 or 6 years.
Yeah.
And $1,500 a week for 5 or 6 years, you know, for 26 episodes, that's kind of a nice amount of money. So we took the lesser of the amount, and it only lasted like 3 weeks. And then it got canceled. It was terrible. It was awful. They didn't even have a drummer. And Jane Gertz was in it. You know, the kids in the band, you'd recognize the cast because they all became somebody at some point. But anyway, that's that story. But the contract we signed said that the new name could not in any way, shape, or form have the word dream in it. And so extreme is a play on words.
I love it.
Perfect. Perfect. And tell us how that name came about. This is a good story.
This is a great story.
Yeah, Sean knows his story. So, I mean, when you read, and you can find this story, and it often says that Paul Geary came up with the name, which to the band, it appeared that way. But Paul and I were actually at my house, and we were in my living room, on the living room floor with a thesaurus, and just trying to come up with names for the band that we could present at a meeting that night. We had to choose a new name. And I just remember my mother sitting in her chair doing her crossword. And my mother was brilliant. She was very clever, funny, but smart. She was, you know, a Mensa member. Yeah. And she over her newspaper, she says, what about extreme? And I didn't get it. I'm just like, yeah, thanks, Mom, no. And she's like, well, I always thought they were a bit extreme. And yeah. I go, really? Because I think they're a little... Pop. I think that, you know, like, when I'm thinking extreme, I'm thinking of Iggy Pop, not, you know, extreme. But anyway, Paul Geary turns to me and goes, no, don't you get it? And he, with the obvious, he said, don't you get it? Extreme. And I said, oh. So he went to the band that night and they all agreed. And that's how the name got changed.
Oh, that's a fantastic story. I love that story.
We took the money. When I said to you, remember I mentioned Jim Carroll's band, because we took that money and we bought some much needed equipment and paid for some studio time, finished our EP. I lied. Not intentionally. The EP was finished. We finished some other recordings that we did with Franchina of Boston producing. The EP was already in the can because I really wanted to do an MTV video. I wanted to enter the MTV basement tapes, and the band wasn't sure that's what they wanted to do, and the video was going to be expensive, and they didn't want to spend all the money on a video, and MTV was young at that point, and but it was happening. It was the place to be seen, and so I strong-armed, and I went out to a little local music conference they had at the Metro, on Lansdowne, and there they unveiled the music video for Bang, which was a Boston band that became Spread Eagle. So, and the video was produced and directed by two guys from Emerson College, Scott Talbert and David Horgan.
Wow.
And I loved it. It was brilliant, and they were entering it into the basement tapes, and that's what I wanted to do. So I made it a point to meet Scott Calvert, introduce myself to him, and told him, I want you to do my dance video. He said, does it work that way? So tell me how it works. And he says, well, what do you have for music and whatnot? So I gave him an EP. It was actually vinyl. And I told him what song and everything, and he's like, no, 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 no. He said, tell you what, I'll listen to this. And I gave him the promo pack, and, you know, there was a lot of news clippings. I'm like, dude, you know, we're going to be it. And he said, I'll be the judge of that, and I'll listen to this. And if there's anything that jumps out at me, I'll let you know. I'll be in touch. And he called me, the next day, and he said, I know which song I want to do, and it was the song I wanted to do, which was Mother Don't Want to Go to School Today. And and they were wonderful. And David was the producer. Scott was the director. And it was incredible. I mean, we had cranes and dollies, and it was just a full production. You can still, you know, you can find that video, the original Mother Don't Want to Go to School video with Peter Hunt in the band of Palming going on bass. And that's on, you know, Yahoo. YouTube.
Yeah,
you can find that on YouTube. Yeah. And my dad,
a lot of times during this series, we talked about how supportive the local community, the music community, the Boston music community has been, whether it's, you know, bands helping each other, the managers, the agents, the radio station was huge. So tell us how the radio got in play with Mother Don't Want to Go to School.
Well, yes, because originally that was, you know, when you hear bands talk about the very first time they heard themselves on the radio.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That was Paul Geary and I were driving down a little street in Medford past the Meadow Glen Mall, and all of a sudden we hear the beginning of Mother, which was the guitar riff. And it was like, what? Turn the radio up. And it's our song. And Carter Allen from WBCN, you know, played the song during a lunchtime, sort of call in and let us know what you think of this new song. And everybody loved it. And again, that was the song we did the video to. I'll make it quick, but the tie into the Jim Carroll is that Scott Calvert was the director and the brainchild, the steam engine behind doing Basketball Diaries, the movie.
Oh, wow.
He had read the book. He had done Marky Mark Wahlberg's music videos.
Yeah.
He knew Mark. He's the one that got all the funding behind it. And he did that movie with Leonardo DiCaprio. But as we know from Columbine, it took it to a whole different level. It was like a cult classic, and then it just became something bigger. And we lost Scott about a decade ago, and he took his life. And I'm not sure really what led up to that, but I know that was tough for him.
Yeah.
But it was a brilliant movie. It was different, and it was haunting, you know, but it was a brilliant movie, and he did an incredible job, and everybody in it was incredible. But anyway, so that's the tie-in to Jim Carroll, was Scott Calvert and us having opened for the Jim Carroll band, and just kind of a strange, extreme lore.
That's cool. A quick question from me, totally different. When did Uno come along?
His name is Nuno.
That's what I said. Nuno is Portuguese. He's Portuguese.
He is a Portuguese. Bom dia. He, ironically, was in the Mother video that Scott Calvert and David Horgan produced and directed. He was one of the kids because it was shot at a school.
Oh.
And we had 100 kids. You know, marching down the street singing Mother Don't Want to Go to School Today. My dad was the teacher in the video. I was a high school teacher myself, and I used to joke with the students, how many of you can say your father was on MTV?
I like it. I like that.
But Nuno was in our video, and he looked like Joe Perry.
Yeah.
He looked strikingly like Joe Perry, like a young Joe Perry. And Gary was just like, enamored by that. And who are you? And he was a guitarist, and he played in his own band. And Gary went to see his band play at the Rat and was just blown away and said, I got to have you in my band.
Yeah.
And so the band, you know, took another direction. And, you know, we lost Peter Hunt in that deal, in that trade, if you will. And that was tough. You know, it's always tough when you're part of a founding member in a band, and then that band goes on to bigger heights, if you will, without you.
That happens.
It's hard.
It is very hard.
And it does happen. It happens more often than not, right?
Totally. No, I just saw...
Nuno, yeah, he's really come into his own right now. He's got his own guitar line out.
Totally. I just saw the Channel 5 interview he had on there on Chronicle. I thought it was brilliant.
Where they went back to his house that he grew up in?
I love it because one of 10 kids that came out of there, and they still play at the veterans' place on certain times, the brothers. And I think that's, just stuff like that is fantastic. You know, I mean, and that keeps you grounded so you don't get away from all that other stuff and all the crazy stuff that goes on with touring, as you know, and what have you. But first time I ever saw him play with Extreme, because I didn't see Dream, I thought that band just knew what they were doing and they're going to big. And I'm so glad Europe took them on, and because they really deserved Europe. They really deserved Europe, and because I know that's where I worked all through the '60s and early '70s. But I knew that they would latch right onto them. They'd love them entirely, and not just Uno, but everybody. The one thing that got me is you were talking about the show that they used to do. Because it was a show, but it was a real musical show too. I do remember, I'm sure Sean remembers the night when the girl gets up on stage at the Channel in a coat and drops a coat in front of her. There's nothing on but the bra and panties and stuff, and she's trying to hump Gary.
I was gone by then.
you were gone home.
I became a mom in 1988.
So you've gone by.
I had already left. Yeah,
you'd got be gone by that. No, there was all the issues that went down. With one side of you and this, that, and the other management and what have you. And at the end of the day, I was so happy that you took it over because it was so nice and wonderful to see a young woman in the business taking over this damn thing and knowing how to do it, because you did know how to do it from the beginning. From those days working in what you did in the beginning. That's why I wanted to know what you did. I'm like, oh my God, this is wonderful stuff.
Yeah, I originally had aspired to just be a fundraiser. Yeah. And I just found working with bands and working with musicians, it was exciting. People love music.
Yeah.
And it was for me, my niche to put these concerts together to help raise money for charities. And it just evolved into that. I'll tell you a funny story, Jinky, because being a woman in the business, today is different. I hope so. And look at Green. I forget her first name, but she manages or has managed Aerosmith for years and years. Woman, you know. But for me, I would get things like I'd be up at the Hampton Beach Casino. We'd be, doing a show, and I'd have like the promoter come up to me and say, so we're having a wet t-shirt contest to open the show, and there's still a spot or two left. You want to get in it? It's $50. You can win $50. And I'm looking at him like, did you ask the guys if they wanted to get it? Like, what? You know, it was just stuff like that. Yeah. I remember one time, I won't mention the club, but you remember Mickey O'Halloran, who, I had a wonderful relationship with Mickey.
Yeah, Mickey is fun.
Was quite a mentor to me. He was always above board. I mean, he was always brutally honest. He never went out of his way to pay us too much money. So, but his advice and his guidance, and so he was managing a club that he had us in regularly. And then we show up one night for a show, and he's gone. He's been replaced by some other guy.
Yeah.
And it was always left to me to make sure the crew gathered up. The band would leave, crew would gather up, I'd go get paid, and we'd get out of there. And I went up to get paid. And the first thing this guy did was he got up and locked the door. And I said, why are you locking the door? And Mickey never locked the door. He goes, whenever I count money, I always lock the door. Okay. So, it's just one of those toggly locks that, go from left to right. And now we Seth's counting out the money, and he has the contract and paperwork, and he counts out the band's money. Here's their money, $500 or something, right? He gives me the paper to sign, and then he counts out $50, puts it in front of me, unzips his pants, and says, "And this is for you."
Yeah.
Oh, and wow. I had to count in my head. I had to think to myself, and I have the long hair, right? I always had the long hair. In my head, I'm thinking, I'm going to pick up that money. I scribbled my name on the thing, picked up the money, left the 50, and turned, and just in my head, I'm thinking, how fast can I get that lock open and get out that door before he's grabbed me by my hair?
Oh, yeah.
That's all I could think of. My heart was in my throat.
Yeah.
We never went back there to play again. But, so crazy stuff as a female manager. Yeah.
That's what I figured. I figured you'd get into it. The only one that wasn't a manager but a booking agent in New York that we dealt with at Premier Talent was Barbara Skydell, and she was a tough one. She
you had to be.
Yeah, and I loved every minute of it when she was booking Fleetwood or any of the groups from that came from England, The Who, all these people and stuff, and she had no messing, right business. Everything was done real well, and. And that was my first time. And then down in the south, there was a couple of ladies that were running bands down there with, 50s and 60s groups and what have you. And I'm saying, yeah, this is real cool, you know, because it's always been a male thing from us in England and all the gangsters and all that stuff that used to run all this stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you get the daughters of gangsters that came out of the...
Right. Because they couldn't trust their son.
Exactly.
But, you know, Sean, you mentioned Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp, because now, sort of fast forward, my kids are raised. I'm ready to, you know, sort of get back in the game. And I had an idea for a TV show using classic rock artists. And I... At the time, Facebook wasn't even around, or it was very in its infancy stage. It was MySpace that was happening.
Yeah.
And that's when I became aware of David Bischoff and Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp. And I was like, I want to meet this guy. And then in 2008, his Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp came to Boston, and they had like a battle of the bands after all the people joined the camps and everything, and whoever sort of won that battle of the bands, they got to open for Extreme.
Yeah.
And so I was backstage, and I just wanted to meet David Bischoff, and Ernie Bloch was like, "You want to meet him? I'll introduce you to him." So he brings me over. I meet David Bischoff, and I'm sorry?
David was a friend. We had him work on when I was working with Mamas and Papas in the 80s, and we were doing Atlantic City. Then we went to he first started booking us into the places in the Catskills, and what have you.
Yeah,
and
he was from that area. Yeah,
we a real quick story about that is one day we're doing the Sands in Vegas. And Frank Sinatra came in, and he'd had a deal with was all upset with John Phillips because John was running around with Frank's wife at one point. And then and we thought this is going to happen. It's going to be a big deal. So, but Frank came backstage, and first thing he said, he says, "I'm going to drop everything from here if you can get me every 60s act to play this. We need 60s acts in the Vegas." So so Al Hirsch and I just looked at each other. David Bischoff, we're going to call the next day we called David. We got we got the association, we got Turtles, you know, because they were old friends of ours anyway. Turtles, we got that kind of groups, the Monkees even, stuff like that. And Gary Puckett was with us a lot and stuff with and what have you. So the next thing, Frank is so happy that he'd heard right away from this guy, David Bischoff, who's going to put all these bands in there. And he started it the week after we left the Sands with all these different groups. And then he had the Monkees do some other stuff for him and whatever. But David, he'd go in his office, and he had a great setup there of Madonna's clothes in a glass case. That big bosom thing, you know.
David was an idea man, and he made he made bank on the Flashdance tour.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, and what he took these artists that had sort of one-hit wonders, and he put them all together and toured them, you know, that's, and it was a, that was a brilliant idea, and he did a lot of that stuff.
That's David. He had a lot of baseball memorabilia. I remember in the office, I was like, oh, look at that, yes. And he's like, it's all signed, Babe Ruth. And
you know, he got the idea for Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp because he was an attorney, but he was a sports attorney.
Sports attorney, and that's what it was.
And he represented some sort of classic, you know, athletes, and they would participate in these baseball camps or these football camps, where people would pay to come and meet their athletic stars. And he came up with a whole nother idea. He's the reason why the NFL and baseball and hockey sell their shirts, their licensed shirts.
Yeah.
That was his idea. But I digress. You can ask him all about that. But he knew how much he loved music. He created Ringo Starr's All-Star Band. That was his idea.
Yeah.
And he just loved music. And his friends would be like, you're having dinner with Ringo and Joe Walsh? Tell me what restaurant it is. I just want to come by and see. And he just saw how excited people would get.
Yes.
And he got this idea. Well, if we could do baseball camps and football camps, why can't we do rock and roll camps?
Yep. Yep.
And he would bring out these classic rock artists from retirement, and they're, you know, their fans would just gush to meet them. And it was a win-win all around.
Oh, totally, totally. And he's a good egg anyway. He's a fun guy. Every time I've had him out there on the road when we did. But that was the 80s, early 80s, when we first started with that lot and what have you. But let's go back to the channel, because I want to ask you about one thing. What do you remember watching certain acts there, which I asked you before, not today, but you sent me a letter on that, email on that, and I'm saying, oh my goodness, you were there when and watched Stephen, James Brown, and all this, that, and
yeah.
So let us know about that.
We went to a lot of shows at the channel, and of course we know the channel had a lot of different acts, but I really think that the one that really stands out for me is being, let's see, stage right, James Brown.
Yeah.
And having him come from that dressing room. Remember the dressing room on the back where the dance floor was, all the way down the end, coming all the way up and coming up on that stage.
Yeah.
And right next to me was Steven Tyler. And being able to watch Tyler's face watching James Brown was more priceless than even watching James Brown, because he was in heaven. He was in awe. He was like a child. He was so excited.
I agree.
And that was a wonderful show.
Oh, yeah. I agree with you totally about that. I sat in the fifth row in San Francisco with all Fleetwood Mac, the blues band with Peter, in 1969, when he just let it rip on this big stage. And I mean, the showmanship, the quality of the music, the way that he was just adoring the crowd. The crowd just loved him, and he loved it back to them. You know, it was like, whoa, this is how an artist should be. This is how it should be. But I saw all those, and when in the 60s, I saw Otis Redding, I saw all the people that came to England on those shows before I even started in the business. And I was just in awe of their performances, every one of their performances, especially a lot of the harmonies of the groups, the Temptations, the old Four Tops, all that stuff was just sensational to me, you know. And then it got into the rock stuff, and things started changing. The blues, White Boy Blues band out of England that I joined with Fleetwood Mac was sensational coming over here with everybody. You know, there was like fresh Boston was our like hometown, because we just get playing at the tea party and whatever and having a great old time.
The clubs, I don't know, you know, I know things ebb and flow, you know. Times they are changing, but that the late 70s and the 80s were just crazy in Boston for wonderful venues, great clubs.
Yeah, definitely.
Being able to introduce, you know, new music. And the channel was integral. I mean, you mentioned Warren Scott or Warren Yaffe earlier. you know, he had such an eclectic mindset when it came to booking that club, and he booked everything. That club was for everybody. You know, some clubs it's like, oh, that's alternative, or that's punk, or you know, and you just kind of had your hangouts and you'd go to just one particular club. But the Channel catered to everyone. It was a incredible you know, staple in music in Boston.
And it was that.
I totally agree with that. I also think Warren gets kind of overlooked a lot, but the booking policy, like you said, of everything. I mean, anything from the R&B acts, like the legacy acts, to the, you know, occasional rap shows, all the rock bands, obviously, but the new bands coming over from England, the punk shows, the new wave music, he tied in all that. It was amazing. One night you might see Slayer there, the next night you might see Rob
Vince Sullivan.
Yeah, and then the Wailers would come through, and Yellow Man, and I mean, every night you could see these incredible international acts. That kind of gets back to the, you know, this is like the thing we talk about all the time. It's kind of hard when it's in your blood, the music is kind of hard to escape it, right? So it's funny. The last time I ran into you, Joanne, was at a an event for the New England Music Awards, and maybe you can just kind of touch a little based on how you were involved with that or what you were doing that night.
Yeah.
I know you have a little bit long. You have to run pretty soon. If you can see it tonight, real quick.
Yeah. I had become aware of this gentleman, Chris, and he had put together this New England Music Awards. And, you know, I thought, that's nice. It's just a nice way to say thank you for the music you brought to New England and, you know, give them the nod and respect and recognition. And I was working with David Hall at the time, a couple years ago. And I felt like, you know, he's a guy that should be nominated at the very least, you know, because he's played with some really, you know, top-notch bands. And he was a kid wonder. He was like a wunderkind, you know. He was like 16 years old playing bass for, you know, incredible artists.
Yep.
And so I approached Chris, introduced myself. And when I did, he was like, oh, my God, which was kind of silly. But, you know, you're doing Cody, whoever that is. And it's because he was a big Extreme fan, and he wanted to induct Extreme. And he was like, how can you help me? And so that's how I got involved. And when I attended the ceremony the night I saw you, Sean, we had this sort of unexpected snowstorm blow in. And a lot of the people that were supposed to come and present didn't make it on time. And Chris had asked me, I was there to induct Joe Petrocelli, and he's another guy that's just, you know, Boston music through and through, with Joe Perry Project, Berlin Ailes, Luna, the, you know, ITMB. And so I was happy to do that. As I said, I had known Joe since I was in high school. And so it was a privilege for me to go and induct him. And while I was there, Chris would just come up to me and say, you know, like, Steve from the Nervous Eaters, can you induct him? And, you know, here's another one, can you induct? So I ended up, like, hosting half the night.
I love it.
It was a lot of fun.
I love it.
Great job for having that, being prepared for it. As your producer and talent manager background, you fit right in. And the control was great.
Thank you.
Yeah, it is.
It was fun. I didn't have time to be nervous.
That's a good thing. I love it. Well,
you know, Dickie, let me just finish on this. You know, I remember when you came to the Channel, it was a big deal. It was kind of like, if we had had a red carpet to roll out, we would have rolled it out. It was like you walked in and it was the talk, you know, Dickie Dawson, he's here. And you know, you brought a lot of excitement to that club. And it's a pleasure to talk to you today. And of course, it's always a pleasure to spend some time with Sean.
Yeah,
he was actually.
It was a mutual. You're right about Dinkin. Everybody wanted to play the Channel, the biggest stage in town, the best system, sound system, bar none. So that was really the day. Every band, even if you're like a one or two gig band, if you played the Channel, you felt like you made it. Like,
yeah,
really something special.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's
20 years later, right?
It was wonderful.
That was your launching pad.
It was wonderful because when I came in, because I'd retired off the road after that, I'd had enough of the road, the way it was changing, and some of my production people changed the whole thing and made it into a business. And I didn't like that. I wanted people to enjoy everything behind the scenes as well as in the scenes, not coming in there and spending $1,000 just to say hello to people and stuff like that, you know. It's out of control in that level, in some levels. But at least I have to say, Europe's not like that. So you play their big festivals like I did even in the 90s with the Inner Circle. We had a wonderful time because they gave love back. They gave the heart back that they used to have in the Channel. And not just the Channel, like I said, every one of those clubs in town were all connected because they'd have their certain shows, then people would come to the Channel after because we were still open till 2 o'clock in the morning and they didn't know the band was going on till 12 midnight.
They would come and hang. And
that's what we miss in town right now. That's what's missing. Although I see Sean's been at a couple of places that I think's really good. This outdoor venue looks very interesting. And it's just it's just some of the politics that that come with all this new stuff. And they want your money from merchandising that you're selling. And the merchandise, as you know, Joanne, kept us all alive in respect of traveling, in respect of food and things like that.
That was how we made, when we were getting paid $50 a gig, that was how we made money.
Well, it's true. You took our $50 a night lighting guy away from us, and he's one of the best in the world right now. And that's Martin Favor. You know, I mean, what he's doing, everybody wants him. All the metal guys want him because of Extreme and the shows that they do.
And Greg Clark.
Greg's another.
Greg's a monster. And Greg, I don't know how true it is, but Greg will always credit me until you gave me my first gig.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
That's real good. All right. Well, we should.
It's been an amazing pleasure.
Yeah. I'm really glad that we got together now after all these weeks I've been trying.
I'm glad you're feeling better, Dinky.
Yeah, I'm feeling a lot better. I could get better and even more psychedelic, let's put it that way. but not lethargic. I just want to be on top of the whole thing. And Sean's with me now doing some of these guest interviews with people like yourself who he knows very well, better than I do, because I've seen you, I've met you, and I've respected you every day since what you've done over the years and continue to do. And I think it's just wonderful that you've had the kids and now you're going back at it full throttle. Get that TV show. They're all looking for content. They got me in a chair yatting. I'm going like, what's that for? Well, that's going to be a documentary on your ass. I go, what? And that's what it is. I say, okay, read my book. And what Carter did it, you'll read the whole story. But the 80s is all different because it's all on podcast now.
Well, keep your eyes open for The Rise of the Hollywood Vampires. Unleashed Spirit. That's with Alice Cooper and...
We may do a Channel show. Sean and I has talked about it for a while. Tony and I and stuff were doing that before he got ill, and we were getting that together to have another one of those because we put one on at the old Bradford Ballroom quite a few years ago. But the first band that cropped up was the Hollywood Vampires. The first band.
I created during COVID. I created a pitch for the documentary, which Chef, greenlit, and subsequently Ernie Bach has produced. And I think they're just waiting to finish signing with a streaming platform, and it'll be out.
Oh, wow.
And they filmed their concert a couple of years ago that they performed here in Boston. So that's in the documentary.
That's awesome. Fantastic. Awesome. That's fantastic. Well, thank you again, Joanne.
Love. Thank you.
Thank you for this time. We'll probably get in touch again because I'm sure Sean would love that as well. And over the time and stuff. But you have a good one and plod on. Just really keep plodding on with what you got going. And you'll find it will keep working for you, because you're a spirit and a half, kiddo. And that's really what it's all about. and the kids love you. I mean, those guys in that band just, yes, Joanne's going to look after us and she's going to do it their way, and then she does a good way. I hear that from
different... Thanks so much, Joanne, for joining us today. It was great.
Yeah.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you again.
And I look forward to listening. All right.
Thank you. It's Two Pints in the Corner signing out.